becomes, peacemaker is of course getting old, that's part of the change, but not only that, he's actually been deposed to a certain extent by Wilhelm II, okay, who's without a doubt the most, I would say, central figure in the German, I would say, politics, even though he has also a symbolic sort of thing, but it's not only symbol, it's not like Queen Elizabeth II, okay? Wilhelm II, we are talking about a monarch, if you want, which has actual power. Now, so it's the question, who is more powerful?
He also wants to show his power compared to Bismarck.
Exactly. Also show a very aggressive foreign policy. That is what's important. Yes, Mendy.
Wilhelm II is the one who was a friend of Bismarck or the enemy?
The enemy.
The enemy. He was the son of his...
Grandson.
Grandson.
Yeah.
Who...
yeah. And what happened, we have a chancellor between Wilhelm I and Alexander, basically, who only rules for approximately 6 to 7 months, dying from cancer, marrying, now it gets complicated, marrying...
Russia?
No, marrying the daughter of Queen Victoria and Albert. And her name is? Why did
Victoria.
Victoria, again. I knew it was... Okay. So Victoria again. Marrying her.
She was the daughter of Victoria, and she was Victoria.
Yeah, her name was. She was named after her mother.
Yeah.
Oh, her mother passed before.
Yeah.
No.
She was just named after.
It's a modern. That's the way they did it. Firstborn child after.
Second to her name.
Yeah.
Queen of the Andals.
And then her husband dies after 7 months. Actually, very. It's a pity. We don't know where history would have led us because he was a very, actually, rather moderate man, considered
who?
At least.
This middle guy.
The supposed emperor was not. We will speak about this. It's just taking us over. Because we are jumping a lot, so I need to give you some background. By the way, the reading is great. I hope you read it. The reading, the book is really good. The book I gave you to read. I know I gave you a lot of reading, but these two chapters I think are very, very good in terms of narrating the story. And then we come to Wilhelm II, who is Ostpolitik. Okay, he's very sort of a foreign policy, I would say, is rather or very aggressive. He wants to put Germany on the world map. Now, there's a problem here.
Against England.
There's no space on the map.
Exactly, there's no space on the map. Where do we have space, a little bit?
Africa.
Libya. Right, totally. So in Africa, and we'll also speak about this in future classes, in terms of the colonies, but in Africa, we have what is sort of vacant. What is
Namibia?
Yeah, so we have Namibia, what is today Namibia, and we have Ethiopia, which is not conquered.
Tanzania,
exactly. Zanzibar. Zanzibar actually exchanged with Heligoland in 1894. Heligoland is a British island in the North Sea. Zanzibar is a German colony. They exchanged between it in 1893-94. I can't remember if it's 3 or 4. Always forget, it doesn't matter. There's a whole ceremony. What's important here, there's no space. Now, where is there another place with vacant space or supposedly vacant space?
The East.
The Middle East.
And the Middle East. But we have two Easts, you're right. First of all, we have the Ostpolitik. We're also going to speak about this in one of the classes. But the Nahe Ostpolitik, Near East politics, if you want, or the Levant, or the Ottoman Empire, as we all know its definition, is the sick man of Europe. This, by the way, is a direct linkage. The Armenian flag is being, until we got an Armenian flag in. I want to take it to my home afterwards.
Put it in my bag.
Put it in my bed. Anyway, so we have this, the Armenian flag, the Armenian Christians who do not have an independence, of course, in those days. Greeks are gaining independence in the 1820s, okay. Bulgarians, Serbs, we'll speak about this, all of those, many of these people getting independence, Romanians, depending how you define Romania, all of them under the Eastern Question. Actually, Thomas wrote some things about this, right? But the early periods a bit.
Yeah.
But he knows, but you know about it. So all of these people are getting some kind of sovereignty during the 1870s. We'll speak about this, don't worry. Importantly, Germany is jumping into the world scene and stopping the very conservative approach of Bismarck. Okay, that is the very important notion that we have to remember. Now, what is coming now is a very important thing. Bismarck is visiting these regions. First of all, he's visiting twice the Ottoman Empire. Okay?
Bismarck.
Not Bismarck, I said Wilhelm II. Yeah. Wilhelm II is visiting this region twice.
89-98.
Exactly, 89-98. 98, by the way, a very famous visit. Also visiting Herzl, by the way. Or meeting Herzl, not visiting Herzl, but meeting Herzl. Also a rare visit of Herzl to these places. He wasn't here now. But pertinent to what I want to speak about today is basically the idea that he is becoming a major player in the politics of what we call the Eastern Question and the Ottoman Empire. Now, all of this Eastern Question, and this is why, actually what he's going also to speak about today, is directly linked to this. Because the Eastern Question, which I've, I'm working on in various aspects, I'm working about the Armenian Question, everything is defined by questions in the latter half of the 19th century. Okay, there's a book by Holly Case, by the way, by the name of The Age of Questions. I also written something about this, doesn't matter. Importantly, what we need to remember is that we have a situation where the Eastern Question is never really solved. Really never solved. Why am I saying this? Armenia, Azerbaijan today, the conflict.
It's the same conflict.
Yeah, to some extent, it's a very sort of, it's I would say, it's waves from the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. Okay,
but also Russia is taking basically the same position,
exactly.
And
Russia, and this is why, if I didn't say it, I will say it now for the first time. There is a long Cold War. The Cold War, I always say this, did not start in 45-49. The Cold War, to a large extent, started actually with Crimea or after Crimea. Okay, by the way, one would say even beforehand. I can also agree with that because there's also a very famous war in 1828 between Persia and the Russians. But that is less important. But mainly after Crimea, we have a Cold War. We have Britain on the one side, Russian on the other side. In between, we have powers like Germany, Austro-Hungary, France, who are all the time trying to make alliances between themselves. Britain, by the way, has a theory or idea of splendid isolation. They do not, they are sustaining the Ottoman Empire. This is something you have to remember. Britain has always sustained the Ottoman Empire as a policy until it didn't. Okay, until basically a decade and so before the World War I, things changed, or even beforehand, but things changed, mainly because, by the way, the rise of Germany. Okay, now this is a very, very interesting and complicated story because what we have is actually the roots of the understanding of what happened in World War I. You see the alliances, right? The alliances are what? We have Germany with?
Austro-Hungary and Italy.
No, Italy. Italy is actually, no, Ottoman. Italy is actually on the other side, but?
The Ottomans.
The Ottomans, yeah. Very, 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 exactly. Now, this is not a new thing. This is a thing that has been built 20 years beforehand. Okay, 20 years beforehand, we already have the roots of the German Ottoman affinity. This is because...
When is this?
This is in the 1990s, when William is actually changing... 1890s, sorry. When William is changing the foreign policy, or much more aggressive foreign policy of the Germans, having his personal connection with Abdul Hamid II, who's of course the Turkish Ottoman Empire, was considered to be a very violent empire, by the way, because of very violent massacres against the Armenians in 1894-96. this, the 1894-96 massacres, in the long 20th century, if we have something, because there's this concept of the short 20th century by Hobsbawm, I want to refer to it as the long 20th century, if you want, because Hobsbawm defines it by the age of extremes, of course, famously. If you define an age of extreme, one needs to really begin with extremes. An extreme started, if you ask me, with that moment already in the 1890s, where we have incidents like the Armenians, so between 100,000 and 300,000 Armenians are being massacred by Abdelhamid II and Kurdish and Ottoman troops.
Why is he leaving Britain and choosing Germany over?
We'll deal with this. I'll go in a second.
Okay,
so, okay? So basically, if we go in a theory of a long 20th century, I'm not saying refuting Hobsbawm, I'm not saying, Eric Hobsbawm is perhaps one of the most important historians of the 20th century. I'm not saying he's totally wrong about this. I'm just offering a different alternative if you want to see extremes in the global age, not only in Europe. Because we also have, of course, the Namibian genocide or the German genocide in Southwest Africa, which we'll also speak about.
They use the gas.
Gas there, yeah. It was used
in Africa, no?
In Africa, but what you used it against in Namibia? That's a good question.
I thought,
as far as we recall, I thought that the first usage of gas, but maybe I'm wrong. We'll have to check. I thought it was only in World War One, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong on this. I have to check if it was already used of gas in. What I do know that. That they, of course, made a concentration camps into a certain extent in Shark Island, it's called. They pushed the Namibians or the Nama and the Herero into the desert. Very sort of practical practices of the Armenian genocide in 1915. Now, what I say today is actually that already in 1894-96. Too many decades. In 1894-96, we already have an incident where Germany is actually starting to back up the Ottoman Empire in its policy against the Armenians. The Brits, on the other hand, are withdrawing because of the massacres and internal politics.
On moral grounds?
Yeah, well, moral grounds. Yeah, one could say also moral grounds. Christian grounds.
Oh,
I would
yes,
even
that's
say.
Different.
Christian,
because they are, have a connection to the Armenians.
Christians are also morals.
Yes, no, but the thing is that they care about the Christian Armenians.
Yeah, they care about the Christian Armenians, that's absolutely correct. The artificial differentiation we are doing between morality and religions, we all do this.
No, it's not what I meant.
I also do it.
No, but I didn't mean that.
I meant
that they like the
Armenians.
Armenians,
I know you didn't mean, but people...
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say, not that you meant that. I know you didn't mean that. What I'm trying to say is that some people, or we tend as societies to differentiate. And of course, these things come to them. Morality is, of course, and, what is the Mosaic Law? Mosaic Law is... Or the Abrahamic, even the Abrahamic law to some extent, if you want to. But the Mosaic law is a famous sort of jargon. It's a universal law in a sense. Okay, it's based on religious, but it's a universal law. So universal religions also have a universal aspect. Okay, it's sometimes hard to see, but it's important to note or to remember. By the way, also racial grounds, because race is a new concept which is emerging, and I think I sent you the article, but I claim that it is what you can call racial humanitarianism. Mm-hmm. So they claim that the Armenians are Aryans, the Brits. And not only because of their religion, we need to help them.
Okay? They're white.
No, white is not the... White, you can use
it's
the word white. By the way, again, Caucasian...
Is there.
Yeah. The whole term, which means white, is because of Blumenbach... which I think I mentioned or didn't mean I mentioned. Blumenbach is the 18th century scholar.
The source of the...
He actually said, that the Eden, the Ararat story, everything is that... There was a lot of connections between that area of Armenia, eastern side of Asia Minor, and paradise and the beginning of human beings, etc., etc., etc. Okay? We leave this aside for a second. Anyway, the term Caucasian comes from Blumenbach. Okay, but what we have is here, the Germans while the Brits are withdrawing a bit from their endless support of the Turks or the Ottomans, mainly because they are afraid of who?
Russia,
exactly. So that is the deal here. We have Russia on the other side and a proxy war between the Ottomans and the Russians. And the Brits are all the time playing the Ottomans against the Russians until they don't. Until the Ottomans are moving, not to the Russian side, of course, because they will be always their enemies, but to the side of Germany. Okay? This is a very, very complicated map. Maybe I should, I can show you this. It's a complicated story, but in general, I hope, and if you read the sources, or if you read the chapters, you'll understand that it's a complicated story, but you need to understand that the Brits are out, the Germans are in general. They are in the sense that during the massacres themselves of Abd al-Hamid, Wilhelm II in 1896 is sending a picture, a portrait of himself to Abd al-Hamid, which was famously hanged in his office. Okay?
So in Abd al-Hamid's office.
Yeah, in Abd al-Hamid's office. Okay, so we have a very, very interesting story here. A very interesting story that tells you, and I know we jumped a lot of decades. I wanted to do something which is actually pertinent and relevant to the topic of today, or the larger topic of today. And this is a new geopolitical game of the end of the 19th century. You have to remember another thing that we'll also mention is the Tirpitz Plan. Okay, the famous, of course, building of the German Navy, exactly the same years. We have a foreign policy which backs itself, but through a military strengthening of the German Navy, German Army, and, not least important, German industry. The Germans are really conducting, of course, we always refer to the German miracle to the years after the Second World War, of course, especially West Germany, if you want a miracle. And then, of course, still going on to a certain extent. But there is also a German miracle to a large extent. I don't know if it's a miracle, is the word. But it's becoming a very substantial player in the world economy and in as a world power. The problem and tragedy, perhaps of all of us, okay, is that Germany could not have, or does not see itself in the bright place that they see themselves as they deserve in the world scene. Okay, so basically they don't have the territories, the colonies, the stature, the image. Because they were late.
They
came late to the party of stealing everyone's land.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were also not so successful.
Also not so successful. That is an argument.
The Japanese weren't so successful.
Yeah.
Yes, but the British came to Africa, there was nothing there, so they could just take whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
The Germans came to Africa, there were British there and French there, but they didn't want the Germans there.
And also you have to remember, I probably mentioned this, but in the 1860s, 10% of Africa is under European control. By 1914, 90% of Africa, even a bit more, is under European control. Germany stays with a little bit of that chunk, of course. We have British and France.
And Belgium.
Belgium is, of course, a cooperation between the powers. All of them, by the way, profit from... If they wanted, Congo would not be in Leopold's hand. Mm-hmm. Leopold, by the way, is also...
Yes, it wasn't a...
No, it wasn't a...
It wasn't truly Belgium?
No, it was Belgium. And they are, of course, responsible for the atrocities of almost 10 million people dying there. Killed, even, in a sense. But it's actually an arrangement between European powers. Because they cannot agree what to do with Congo, they give it to the Belgian, to a large extent. You have to remember also that Leopold I and Leopold II are coming from...
British.
Actually, German. But you're right.
And
linked through... actually, it's through Albert, I think. Are they linked through Albert? I think through Albert. I'm not sure.
But. Yes, but also Leopold is Victoria's uncle because her mother was German.
Leopold I.
Yes. No, the second.
No, second.
The second.
Victoria, the wife of
Albert, like Queen Victoria.
Not the daughter. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good that they're. We have
Belgium itself was an arrangement between the power, the superpowers.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, 1830.
Yeah.
1830, an arrangement, of course, without a doubt, French. So we have, Yoav, you can stay in my class for another 15 minutes.
Ah, still your class?
Yeah, still my class. Come, please. This is, Yoav Lev is an Armenian expert. Speaks Armenian, reads Armenian, speaks Armenian, and a photographer. Sorry. Okay, so we have a very complicated situation. Where, first of all, this genealogy connections between the European monarchies. By the way, as you all know, we have cousins here, okay? The English, the German, and the Russian are all cousins.
They're all German.
They're all German to a certain extent. Yeah, you can say they're all German. It's a yeah. And of course, Victoria is their grandmother. Okay, of all of them. But again, going a bit backwards, so we have this connection. The Brits are going backward with the relation with the Ottomans. Now, this is so harsh that in 1894-95, a British government is resigning because of the Armenian question. I don't know if you heard the name of Rosebery. One of the prime ministers, in between Gladstone, we have the Israeli Gladstone, and then we have Salisbury, of course. But in between them, we have 1 year of a prime minister by the name of Rosebery. One of the reasons he resigns is because of the Armenian question, because the British public is really supporting the Armenian cause. Okay? So there is an antagonism towards the Ottoman Empire.
While he was not. Rosebery or whatever.
No, he was, but not enough. Not enough. He was. The tragic, or not, I don't say tragic, doesn't matter if it's a liberal or conservative government in Britain, they did not change their policy against the Ottoman Empire, or they did not turn against the Ottoman Empire until the late 1890s. And probably also because of the first Armenian massacres. Okay? So we have a very, very a delicate and complicated geopolitical connections here. Importantly, 1894, Russia and France are signing a treaty. Now, the treaty beforehand is actually between Germany and Russia, and they do not renew this treaty. Now, again, you see the powers of World War One are shaping 20 years and even before the eruption of war. And that is very, very important to understand. We have a very delicate and complicated. Shama bachutz. Toda. I'm doing a thousand things together. So, thousand things to read. Okay, so very sophisticated and complicated situation. And then there's another treaty section. Between France, later in the first decade, we have the triple treaty, okay, between Russia, France, and Great Britain.
Is that a reaction to the German move?
Absolutely, and also a reaction to the German move. But what I want you actually to remember here that the Eastern Question, as we call it in the 19th century, was actually never solved. Part of the reason why we are so much entangled also in this region with territorial disputes, etc. The entanglement of the Balkan, the entanglement of the Kurds, Iraq to some extent, the whole region, Egypt to some extent, but mainly the Levant and upwards towards the Caucasus and the Balkan, is mainly because the situation of the Eastern Question was never really solved. Now, I'll tell you more than this. The eruption of World War One. Of course, we have Alsace-Lorraine, we have 1871, we'll learn about this in terms of Germany and France, but it's also a resort, and it's not, of course, it's a symbol that Duke Franz Ferdinand is murdered on the bridge okay, in the Balkan, of course, yeah, in Sarajevo. But what's important to remember here is this is a symbol, but it's a symbol that tells us a lot, that the Balkan Wars and the fact that their things are not getting into some kind of the break of the Ottoman Empire is not really organized enough or solidified enough between the powers, and you have this constant ethnic clashes in that region again until today. The Yugoslavic, the wars of Yugoslavia in the 1990s is a direct result of that situation. They were halted for many years because of Tito and the Soviet Union, etc. There was communism and so on, right? But underneath, those ethnic, very problematic relations were there because the Eastern question, or the Armenian question, and the Bulgarian question, and whatever question you want to question as a problem, were not solved in that end of the century.
Can you define what you call the Eastern question? Okay, what is the question?
Okay, so we define it by question, but it's actually a problem.
Yeah, okay.
A question is a problem, and yeah, we'll define it as a question because what it means, it's the power game between the European powers, diplomatic, even military sometimes, regarding the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. Okay. So what should one do with the Ottoman Empire? Now, this is the small Eastern question. There's a larger Eastern question, which basically means that we have a situation where we have this antagonism between Russia and Britain, and sometimes it's not necessarily defined as the Eastern question, but it's part of the Eastern question, about Afghanistan, India, those regions. Okay. But the Eastern question mainly...
But that is pretty much solved.
Yeah. No.
Britain has no...
No, you're right. The Britain is just replaced by other Western powers, in that sense. Crimea... If you want to understand Crimea in 2014,
yeah,
this is, again, I'm not saying, it's not there's a direct linkage with the middle of the 90s, but of course there's almost a direct linkage between, you know, enduring problems within the region which are never solved in the way that the disintegration of empires, by the way, not only them, also the Austro-Hungarians, okay? The whole notion of nationalism, which is, we are almost grown to it, and I told you this is the main the phenomena of the 20th and 19th century. If there's something about modernity, it's not the Industrial Revolution, it's not AI, it's also this. But it is mainly the emergence of modern nationalism, a concept that was not there before, wasn't there before, and not in the sense that we understand it today. The main fact is that we have empires throughout most of history. And once those are collapsing and we are coming to the idea or notion of states defined by nationalism, and of course there's proto-nationalism, whatever you want, then we are coming to a new age which was never seen in the history of mankind, in a sense. And that is the age of nationalism. That's how you should actually call what's happening in the whole world, by the way, since the sort of the middle of the 19th century. Okay, so that is the that is a very... Can you answer, Dico?
We met a million things.
Sorry, no, it's because people are... okay. Now, speaking about Germany, one of the main endeavors, and this is the reading for today, is the whole... Baghdad-Berlin Railway. So basically a great economic project, which is exactly the epitome of the very complicated relations between the powers. Because the Germans cannot be at the front of this project. Who knows why? If the Germans would have been in the front of a project of the Baghdad-Berlin Railway, what will happen?
What was the question?
Why they cannot be at the front of the project? Yeah, the Germans.
They'll sort of replace the British, no?
Almost there. But if they'll be at the front and not have British and French interests within the project, that's what they do. Like
so they will
stop
it.
A bit like the Swiss. they will stop it. So first of all, the Russians will attack, okay? The Brits and France and French will attack, right? The Germans cannot actually lead it. They are very much involved with the technicians. Siemens is very much in the project, funding the German banks are funding this, right? There's a whole national project here. But again, tells you that the Germans are seeing this region here as a place where they could expand to. Because we have a very problematic Ottoman Empire. By the way, an Ottoman Empire that probably without World War I will never fall. We don't know, it's not a historical question, but to a large extent, I don't think it's falling if there's no, even though it's crumbling for years.
What is crumbling?
The Ottoman Empire was crumbling throughout all of the 19th century since they lost, if you want, since they lost Greece, even beforehand, by the way, from the Napoleonic Wars, since they lost to...
I mean, it's becoming...
Okay.
Sorry. דיקו אומר שהוא העביר פרטים על החנייה ולא נותנים לי להיכנס.
תשאל את אלישבע בחוץ.
הוא בחנייה של מדעי הרוח, זה מה ש...
כן, תשאל את אלישבע בחוץ, עם האדום. Sorry for this. Too many things, it's a... Okay.
Sucky dog. Delegate. Sorry. The responsibility.
Today is a very because of the foreign minister. Anyway, so we have this sort of Baghdad-Berlin project. They cannot be at the front of it, and we have very delicate situations here. But what this tells us that they see the Ottoman Empire as a potential
place to expand.
Place to expand. Okay, because Africa is not really possible. Another very possible place, of course, which are trying throughout all this and we learn about it, is Drang nach Osten. And that is basically the drive to the east. Poland. Now, Poland is under German, part of it, is under Prussian-German hands, of course. What they're trying to do throughout the 19th century, especially after unification, is actually make a Germanization project throughout Poland. And then you can also understand how the Poles are actually reacting after the Nazis are losing the war. 60, 70, 80...
That they kicked everyone out.
They kicked everyone out. Almost 10 to 13 million Germans are kicked
many
out.
Many died.
And many died, yeah. Okay, so we have a very, very...
The Germans' banks were able to finance it themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good question. The German
didn't they need any British or French money?
They also had it, but they did not need the money. They needed, like you do in international relations, they needed the legitimacy. Okay, they needed the legitimacy.
But not the liquidity.
No, I would say they had the money. We are talking about the power in Germany who's starting to compete with the most the greatest empire in world history, the British Empire, in terms of naval capacity. Now this is the thing, they're always behind, but they still compete.
The reason I'm asking is that the French, for example, had big issues creating the Suez Canal without British financing, and vice versa. And
yeah, but
these projects are like beyond
absolutely
what they had back then.
It's not only the financing, it's also the Brits are much more dominant in the region. I want to remind you, of course, they are taking over Egypt in 1882. They're
yes.
taking over Cyprus at the same year. This is, by the way, the beginning of the break between the Ottomans and the Brits. Not yet. Because the Ottomans do not see in a good eye, let's say this way, the fact that the Brits are entering into the Egyptian sphere. I want to remind you, if you read the chapters, he was speaking also about three figures who are actually very much involved in this. First of all, we spoke about Wilhelm II. He has this fascination from the East, from the Orient, etc.
There's this guy that was...
exactly. Who?
Well, I forget his name.
Oppenheim.
Oppenheim, yeah.
We have Oppenheim. Who's
who was apparently... fascinated by Eastern culture and
exactly, he's a sort of a almost Edward Said Orientalism. So that's like even though, by the way, Edward Said, part of the problem in the book is that he does not relate to German figures or to Germans. That's part of the criticism.
He's more like Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, he's exactly on the Arabia. His mother is Christian. His father is Jewish. He does not portray himself as Jewish. It's a
rather that's why he's Oppenheim. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That's why he's Oppenheim. Of course, is even though you can also find a
it's pretty Jewish.
Anyway, but what's interesting about this is the Germans, and we can also go to Troy. And of course to Schliemann, right? To the whole adventures in Troy, they are culturally and archaeologically starting to get into the region. Now you go to Pergamon, of course, in Berlin today. You go to the museum. That is the most again the same period, where they actually. Not only in terms of geopolitics, economics, but also a cultural endeavor to excavate and research the East. So again, Schliemann and Troy, Oppenheim. By the way, Oppenheim's first finding is really is actually in Syria, not in this region, in Syria. But most of his life he lives in Cairo. His successor in Egypt, Pfeffer, is also there. So basically, we have Germans who are coming here, and through cultural endeavors are also, I would say, strengthening their relations with the Ottomans. Now, it's also through cultural relations and links that you're trying to undermine the British and French, but mainly British influence in the region. Okay? Good. So today is a really short and different... because we have the delegacy. If you want to say, please stay. I just have to go and greet the Vice Foreign Minister.